Let us now pirouette to Central Asia. What used to be known as the Great Game was a reference to that 19th century rivalry between Britain and Russia for influence in the Central Asia region. But after Russia dissolved the Soviet Union and abandoned the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 former republics in 1991, we've seen the emergence of a new Great Game in the Central Asian republics. This one pits America against the former leader in the region, Russia, and the emerging colossus of China. But in spite of the presence of US and Russia, many experts believe that China is already the dominant economic power in the region. Now, next year's departure of US and NATO troops from Afghanistan could see the region at a tipping point similar to what it faced a while ago. Now, I'm pleased to be joined from New York by Alexander Cooley. Alexander is a leading scholar on Central Asia and professor of political science at Columbia. His latest book is called Great Games, Local Rules, The New Great Power Contest in Central Asia. Welcome to our little wireless program, Alexander. 22 years ago, Central Asia dithered after the departure of modern Russia. Does the imminent departure of US and NATO represent a similar challenge?
It might, Philip, it might. And thank you for having me on to discuss the topic. I think we're at an inflection point in the region where we have had about 12 years now, especially since 2000-2001, of a type of three-way competition or at least intense interaction between Russia, China, and the U.S. in the region. And I think the U.S. departure is creating an inflection point, much like the Soviet collapse created an inflection point. Now, I like the term that you used about the end of the Soviet Union. I think you rightly said that Moscow abandoned these places. I think it's interesting that these were former republics that did not actively campaign for their independence. Unlike the Baltic states or some of the Caucasus states, you had no mass mobilizations or nationalist protests or demands for autonomy. It was rather what some scholars have called an unwanted independence. So we started with that as a baseline. And at the time, it speaks more to our paucity of understanding of these places. We just assumed that they would follow the typical post-communist paradigm, that they would enter into a state of transition from a communist party system to a democracy and from a planned market system to a capitalist market internally. Externally, no one really paid that much attention. Russia had its own woes. It was weak. It was not an intense region of interest for the West. And China was still coming to grips with the border issues. But now we see on both fronts real differences. We don't have transit. Yeah.
Alexander, when the Soviet exited stage right, the leaders of the republics plural, pledged an economic union. Did that happen?
Absolutely not. And in fact, Central Asia, by all good indicators of, say, time that it requires to import something or export something, is at the bottom of the list in the world. This is probably the least functioning formal economic region that you can find. And part of that is a function of some of the intense rivalries and egos that emerged amongst the presidents. And part of it is a function of the types of patrimonial social and economic systems that developed in all these places, where state bureaucracy, red tape, borders are monetized, and there are very few incentives to actually freely trade with one another. So the pledge for Central Asian unity, despite a number of different summits and vows, has never materialized.
Alexander, an old friend of the program, Ahmed Rashid, says we cannot blame the external big guns for the fact that large parts of Central Asia are more unstable by the year. He says, and I'm sure you would go along with this, that local rivalries have worsened over the past two decades as each regime has offered more and more corrupt, power-hungry, visionless leadership.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we, in retrospect, the 90s was a decade of power consolidation on behalf of all these regimes. So not only did they not transition to a democracy, they spent this decade building up their security services, acquiring a much as wealth as they could for private purposes, setting up the instruments of state power to serve them and their regime's survival. The question now is, how long can these political systems endure? In the two biggest, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, we are nearing the end, although we say this every year, of the tenure of the two post-Soviet leaders, Nazarbayev and Karimov. And the question of what happens next, who follows succession, is very much open.
Alexander, most of the Central Asian states remain dictatorships, of course, apart from little tiny Kyrgyzstan. So certainly there's been, well, precious little progress on the democratic front, lots of lip service, especially to the Americans.
Yeah, so there's been an interesting regression in the region. I call it normative regression in my book, but actually the region, by most accounts, civil society, democratic indicators, is worse off than it was in 2000 when the West started systematically engage with it. Now, this is not to argue that it's U.S. involvement that caused this regression, but rather it's the accumulation of interest by the U.S., by China, and by Russia, and the attempt of all three to curry favor with these regimes that has given them renewed self-confidence and also empowered them to push back on Western demands for human rights and greater economic openness. Because when push comes to shove, what all of these Central Asian states have learned over the last 10 years is that the West privileges security over human rights in its interactions, and they've even started framing the trade-off as such.
LNL on RN, and I'm talking to Alexander Cooley, Professor of Political Science at Columbia. Alexander, the teeny-weeny Kyrgyzstan, no resources, 5.5 million people living in the high mountain ranges, they've apparently tried to introduce democratic reforms.
Yeah, they have. And initially, in the 90s, Kyrgyzstan crafted an image under then-President Askar Akayev of being a progressive, more enlightened, politically open place. It still is comparatively, but Kyrgyzstan has also seen extremely volatile politics. It's had two presidents overthrown by violent street processes in the period of 5 years, in 2005 and 2010. 2005 is the so-called Tulip Revolution. That was the last of the color revolutions that swept across the Eurasian space. But what replaced Askar Akayev was Kurmanbek Bakiyev, who was even more brash, even more power-hungry, and rivaled his Central Asian neighbors in terms of his brutality towards the end of his term. He was also deposed in 2010. So they're very much now trying to experiment with a more parliamentary-oriented system. But in many cases, the Kyrgyz politics becomes quite chaotic, and it's still not clear whether the democratic experiment is going to succeed over the long term, especially given the fact that its relations with Russia have grown closer and closer over the last 2 years.
Alexander, you've written that the Central Asian government's commitments to protecting political rights, human rights, have been shredded in the name of counterterrorism, and it's interesting that the U.S. continued to hand out funds even after a crackdown on demonstrators in Uzbekistan in 2005, yes, that's right, that saw over 800 people killed.
Yeah, so the Andijan massacre, as it's called, the Andijan crackdown, occurred in May 2005 in the eastern city of Andijan, Uzbekistan. And there are conflicting accounts about what happened, but the bottom line is that Uzbek security services fired into a crowd of street protesters. They claimed that they were responding to a jailbreak by extremist elements, but there's no doubt that most of the bodies involved were civilian casualties. This was the greatest government-sponsored crackdown, most horrendous, since Tiananmen Square. That set into motion a real chain of events as far as the U.S. was concerned. The U.S. Bureaucracy was split on whether to condemn or remain silent. The State Department came around to the international position, demanded international inquiry. The Pentagon was more concerned about retaining access to its air base at Karshi Kanabad in southern Uzbekistan that was being used for Afghanistan. But in the end, the U.S. was evicted anyway that summer. And then relations between the U.S. and Uzbekistan deteriorated. There was more low-level cooperation, but then they picked up again in 2008 when, because of attacks on supply lines in Pakistan, the U.S. required an alternative logistical route to bring materials in. And all of those routes, the so-called northern distribution routes, northern distribution network, almost all of them funneled through Uzbekistan. So the U.S.-Uzbek relations picked up again since 2008, and they've been growing ever since.
Can you explain to me why the paradox of Russia's attitudes, they're contradictory? For example, it wants the U.S. to leave Afghanistan, but is clearly fearful of the Taliban influence.
You're absolutely right, Philip. It's not easily explainable. And I think the best way to think about it is in terms of what Russia actually wants. And what it wants in terms of Central Asia is a type of social status, that Central Asia represents a Russia's sphere of privileged influence. It helps define it as a great power. It justifies its seat at the Security Council. So depending on its interactions, Russia feels either threatened or empowered by the West. So a lot of your listeners might be interested to know that initially after 9/11, President Putin green-lighted the U.S. using military bases in former Soviet territories in these countries because he thought that Russia would mediate relations between the West and the Central Asian countries, that Russia would be a close partner in the Afghanistan campaign. Now, that didn't happen. The U.S. started dealing directly with these militaries, started engaging bilateral security assistance. So at that point, Russia became threatened, and it viewed U.S. presence in the region as competing with it for influence. So Russia has oscillated wildly back and forth, in part because of the types of insecurities it has, wanting to be perceived as the number one privileged power.
Now, if we look at trade figures, we see that China's trade with Central Asia is rocketing. It was $1 billion in 2002. It's up to $28 billion at the last count. By contrast, Russia's trade in 2010 was a miserable $15 billion. So China's broken Russia's monopoly with oil and natural gas. Tell us about the pipeline it's building across the region.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, those figures are probably double. Those are conservative estimates, and the Central Asian countries all downplay in their formal statistics the amount of trade they do with China for political reasons. But yes, one of the accomplishments of China is that it actually has built two significant energy pipelines in the region. The West has talked about building pipelines, but it never managed to do it. China has built an oil pipeline that extends from the shores of the Caspian across Kazakhstan, funneling a lot of these medium and smaller oil fields in Kazakhstan into China. And then, perhaps even more significantly, a new gas pipeline, the Central Asia-China gas line. It originates in Turkmenistan, passes through Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and brings natural gas to China.
You've got a rather cute way of describing it. A growing, sucking sound coming from the east.
Yes, it's sort of a giant straw that the Chinese have put in there. I mean, a couple of remarkable things. One is how quickly they built it, right? In a period of sort of 3 years, this thing is up and running. Two, they successfully broke Gazprom's monopoly in the region. Gazprom always had this fear that the breaking of the monopoly would come from a Western-oriented project. It came from an Eastern-oriented project. And just to give you an idea, at the moment, the government of Turkmenistan has pledged 65 billion cubic meters, currently about half of Beijing's natural gas needs to China for the near future in exchange for loans. So within the space of 2 years, in 2009, Turkmenistan traded the patronage of Russia and Gazprom for the patronage of China and CNPC.
The International Crisis Group recently reported that China's business practices are providing a negative image in a region where suspicions of China are already high.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. First of all, we have to realize the volume of Chinese investment in economic activity is just so intense now that it's visible everywhere. To be fair, China is the only external power building infrastructure in the region. No one else is doing it. It's building highways, roads, dams, railways. So the Chinese are very visible, and Chinese workers are very visible. At the same time, there are growing perceptions that the Central Asian elite is being paid off to engage in a lot of these projects. I'll give you one example that the International Crisis Group also pointed to. China helped finance a large highway in Tajikistan. And the project, after it opened, a couple of weeks after toll booths went up, and an offshore registered company started collecting money for the use of this road that had been paid for, presumably by China. And some local investigative reports have traced this company and registered in the British Virgin Islands to be connected with the presidential inner circle. So there is a lot of questions about the governance and transparency of a lot of this Chinese investment in foreign aid.
Ahmed Rashid reckons the Chinese could play a significant role in peacemaking in Afghanistan or in relations with the Taliban. What do you reckon?
It's a possibility. I think that China has to decide how engaged it's going to be with the region. So for the longest time, I would say to about a year and a half, 2 years ago, its posture was very much free riding on the American and Western security umbrella in the region. It had significant investments, including in Afghanistan mines, has now significant oil investments, but it relied on U.S. security to pursue those. Now the question is, with the U.S. withdrawing, to what extent is China willing to assert itself in Afghanistan and the rest of Central Asia, something it's been reluctant to do? And it's not clear at all that they're still willing to put boots on the ground. Training, yes, money always, but actual physical security presence, they still haven't committed to that.
Now, let's introduce the Uyghur Muslim population. China's managed to silence them, but nationalist sentiment amongst the Uyghurs must still be seething away.
Yeah, and you've seen an uptick in violent incidents again this year. Of course, there were the Urumqi protests and crackdown in 2005. Essentially, what China has done with its Central Asia policy is made it a function of its Western Xinjiang policy, where the Uyghurs reside. And that is to create networks with the Central Asian security services to clamp down on the borders, crack down on Uyghur activities, and to create this mechanism, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, through which it can combat the so-called three evils. And the three evils taken straight out of Chinese security doctrine are extremism, terrorism, and separatism, or splitism. That's a clear reference to Xinjiang. Now, China pursues a kind of a variant of modernization theory. It believes that if it funnels enough money out west, if it invests in infrastructure, if it brings sort of economic modernization, if it links up that area to the greater Central Asian area, then it will prosper, develop, and nationalist sentiments will subside. It's not clear to me that that's at all a good theoretical assumption.
Let's circle back to where we started. As you point out, the leaders in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan have been in power for decades. Do you see battles for succession generating crises in the region?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing one right now in Uzbekistan where factions have already emerged in anticipation of the end of President Karimov's term 2015. Most intriguingly, his quite reviled daughter, Gulnara Karimova, who has been quite an international celebrity, held a number of ambassadorships, cut pop albums, runs many sort of fashion shows and sort of high society events. She has had her assets stripped in Uzbekistan, a lot of her businesses closed. And in part, this might be a response to some ongoing investigations in Europe that have targeted a lot of her holdings. And it might just well be the case that the vulnerabilities that she's shown in these external probes have been a bridge too far for a lot of Uzbek elites, and she's now being marginalized in terms of the succession battle. So we're already seeing this jockeying for position, but we still don't know what the end game is going to be in any of these places.
Alexander, the main regional problems which could be start to be felt after the US and NATO withdrawal, primarily internal, or do they come from things like Russian instability?
I believe that they're internal, but I believe the external dimension exacerbates them, right? So I think internally you're looking at real problems of human security, corruption, governance problems, let's call what it is kleptocracy throughout the region, and you're seeing growing nationalism across the region, something you didn't see in the 1990s when national identities weren't strong anymore. You saw this, for instance, in southern Kyrgyzstan in 2010 with violent ethnic clashes between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks in southern Kyrgyzstan. And so you're seeing a consolidation of national sentiments and a growing sense that these states are not delivering public goods for their populations. I think Russia is exacerbating in some ways the situation because they are preemptively moving to strengthen their hand, especially in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, in anticipation of the U.S. withdrawal. And that creates this spiral of perception that the area is becoming more and more militarized and that it's uncertain. So I actually think it's a dangerous moment in Central Asian affairs, exactly because no one really has a blueprint for what comes next.
And of course, the U.S. withdrawal also means a reduction in their ability to manipulate or profit politically from the region.
I think that's right. And it's that third leg of the stool that the Central Asian states are going to miss out on. And what the U.S. withdrawal is going to do, they won't be totally withdrawn. There'll still be some engagement, although they are leaving places like Kyrgyzstan and the Manas Air Base there. But what U.S. disengagement will do is it will magnify the Russian-Chinese relationship much more. And I think it will bring some of the hidden competition that you've had between Moscow and Beijing, and it will throw into much sharper relief. And so it'll be much more difficult for the Central Asian states to maintain a balanced or multi-vector type of policy.
Before I started talking to Alexander, he confessed on air to no less than six coffees, so I'm going to call him Alexander Caffeinated Cooley. He's professor of political science at Columbia. His book is called Great Games, Local Rules, The New Great Power Contest in Central Asia. I'll now let you go off and have your seventh coffee. Oh, I should mention that the book is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you, Alexander.
Thank you, Philip. It's been a pleasure.
That's a wrap for tonight. And talking about wraps, you'll be wrapping your Chrissy presents, won't you? Well, I'm sure you'll want to wrap up one of the Late Night Live's new USB sticks, available at all ABC shops, centres and online. It's a tiny little flash drive that lets you listen to 20 classics from the past year on your computer, your television, your car, or your stereo. Or you can just shove it in your ear. There's Keating, Bob Rogers, Robin Nevin, Tim Minchin, the splendid Deborah Cheatham, and, yes, a video of my interview with the wonderful Gillian Mears. On our final program for the year, our final live program, our all-star cast reviewing this 12-month and peeking into the next, Laura Tingle, John Birmingham, Paul Collins, Satyajit Das. Don't miss it. Bye for now.